Welcome to the Practical Futurist Podcast, a bi-weekly show all about the near-term future with practical advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and practical futurist, Andrew Grill.
Welcome to episode 6 of the Practical Futurist Podcast, where I'm joined by former IBMer and Bloomberger, Ethan McCarty. A former journalist, Ethan joined IBM in early 2000 to manage the web presence for IBM's $6 billion a year research division. He also co-authored their groundbreaking blogging guidelines, launched IBM's intranet podcasting platform, and worked on IBM's award-winning annual report to shareholders. He is now the CEO of Integral Communications Group, a consulting firm specializing in employee activation, as well as a master's level lecturer on digital media and employee communications for Columbia University. Welcome, Ethan.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's a pleasure to have an opportunity to talk with you.
So we've both worked at IBM, and you also worked at Bloomberg. For those who don't know you, what's been your journey here, and why did you set up a firm that's focused on employee engagement and activation?
Well, you know, I've kind of been in the business for, more than 20 years of kind of inspecting the space and optimizing and activating that space in between organizations and their people. It wasn't some grand plan or anything. I have an undergraduate degree in creative writing and a master's degree in liberal studies, which was kind of like theories and, philosophy and economics and stuff. So there's not like a job path where you're like, oh, go do that. I've had this by luck, really, rather than by design, this opportunity to work on one project after another over the course of my career. An organization desires some kind of outcome, and they need their people to do it, but it's not clear who their people are. Is it the employees? Is it alumni of the organization, the customers, is it communities? And so that space, whether you're, developing what's so-called externally communicated versus what's internally communicated is really blurry. And I think that's a function of a digital transformation that's been taking place over the last 20 years. And so I had those roles at IBM where, simultaneously I managed, an intranet for a business unit for the research division at IBM, as you mentioned. And then at the same time, I managed the IBM.com, the external facing website. And then, I had a time when I was running IBM's intranet and at the same time ran the alumni program, which we grew to over 100,000 members. And so it's like these spaces that are like, well, is that internal communications? Is that external communications? And again, that's been the kind of recurring theme. At Bloomberg, I had similarly, these kind of internal responsibilities, so-called internal communications responsibilities with executive comms and so on. And then I also had a, public relations component and multimedia production. So again and again, these things get conflated that are very often hardwired organizationally. So you'll have like a marketing department or a PR department that's focused externally, and then an HR department or an internal comms department that's focused internally at many organizations. And it's that space in between where I think there's tremendous opportunities for organizations to really differentiate themselves and grow.
Well, I'm so pleased to be talking to you, not just because you're a great guy and a friend of mine. This is a subject really close to my heart. Like you, before I joined IBM, I had my own social presence. I had some level of notoriety around the world. And when I joined IBM, it was like, well, how do we harness that? How do we bring that external and internal view together? And in fact, I wrote a blog post a few years ago entitled Employee Advocacy Beyond Please Retweet This. And I think in 29, it still resonates. I read on your website, you're quoted as saying, employee engagement means much more than just communicating to employees. It drives employee behaviors that enhance sales, attracts and retains talent, makes the organization more secure, and maximizes the return on the firm's investment in its people. So if this is true, how do you measure employee engagement?
Well, I think it's a really good question. You have a lot of different ways to gauge whether or not the workforce is engaged at all. There are some kind of, let's say, standard methods or methods that have become standards that I think are useful. There's a, you know, a poll that you can buy, you know, that you can run at, or, you know, kind of a survey that you can run at whatever frequency, every other year or once a year, you know, that asks some of these questions, like, do you have a best friend at work? And, you know, do you think the company's best days are ahead of it, and so on? And I think those are really, really useful measures. You know, when I think about employee engagement, I tend not to think of it as a single number.
The other thing I think is a proxy we can look at, I'm sure you measure this as well, is if, like you and I, when we were at IBM and Bloomberg, we would put that we work there on our Twitter profile. So someone wanting to say, what's it like to work at IBM or Bloomberg, would look at us as a proxy and say, Andrew and Ethan seem to be having a good time. They talk about the company organically and authentically. So if I work there, I might have a similar experience. And I think a lot of companies, they're trying to force their employees, you know, like I said, please retweet this. But if you put it on your bio and you're proud to work there and you say great stuff about being there, that can only help attract new talent to the firm.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. And I think, you know, one of the trends, you know, we have this kind of 10 trends thing that we talk about, is that so-called internal communications is the new killer app for recruitment. You know, that was certainly the case at IBM and at Bloomberg. You know, many of our clients, you know, the work that we do starts off as a recruitment effort. And how do we externalize, so to speak, some of the great things that are happening inside of a company as a way to make it clearer what the benefits are for working there? And it works both as an attractor and as a useful passive filter. You know, so for example, you know, if your company has a very strong culture of non-hierarchical leadership, and the employee shared ephemera, you know, the videos, the tweets, the blog posts, the speaking engagements, the open houses, like all those things where, you know, employees have a chance to represent what the, you know, life is like at that company. If all of those things depict that accurately and authentically, and somebody who really craves a hierarchical working experience and really likes that sees that and they decide, oh, that place is not good for me, that's actually a wonderful outcome. That's a great positive. And just as much as the opposite is true, you know, like you may, like just by doing those same behaviors and enabling employees to, you know, authentically represent, you know, their work and their work style and, you know, how they view their relationship to that organization, that may just as well function as an attractor for other folks who are like, man, I've been suffering under the thumb of this hierarchical company over here. I could really shine at that company that doesn't have a very hierarchical culture.
So Integral looks at employee engagement and activation. So how do you activate employees?
When we talk about activation, we generally think about it in, you know, in terms of our company's offerings. Anyway, we think about it as in three ways. And the first one would be the work that has historically been called internal communications. So we kind of turn it on its head because we really, really focus on listening first as opposed to talking first. So one dimension of activation is this idea of, you know, you've got two ears and one mouth, you know, use them in the proper ratio, you know, as you're developing communications plans. And so much internal comms at big companies tends to be, okay, here's a message, let's kind of interrupt the audience of employees with this message. And it misapprehends the workforce as kind of passively awaiting interruption, when actually we know that that degrades the employee experience significantly. So our practice of internal communications as part of activation generally leans heavily on both passive and active listening at higher frequencies, shorter intervals, you know, lighter weight touch points. So that's one dimension of it. Oh, and by the way, and that can relate to any of the traditional ways that we do internal comms. So whether that's a executive speech at a town hall or an intranet redesign or a installation of digital signage or, the work that happens around using collaborative tools like Yammer or Slack within an organization. So all of that listening first kind of activity, then introducing, you know, some big, beautiful ideas. The second dimension of activation that we look at is digital transformation, which I know is a topic close to your heart. And there's two sides to that. There's, you know, the marketplace disruption that happens within pretty much every industry as, you know, as the incumbents are challenged by new entrants because of, you know, how digital can change business models. So contending with the change that happens around that. But then also many companies are in a moment of introducing a broad array of new technologies, you know, and whether that's something as quote unquote simple as rolling out a mobile employee experience or something much more, let's say, complicated, like rolling out, you know, intelligent agents that might, you know, operate in a chat to answer questions for them. Those new methods of work, that kind, like accommodating that kind of digital transformation is a point of employee activation that I think is absolutely critical. And then the last is, you know, we look at culture within organizations and the relationship between culture and brand. And, you know, you have a real opportunity right now to create organizations that people feel like they want to be a part of because they total up to something greater than just, you know, my daily wage. And that idea of purpose-led organizations, of organizations that have a culture that is an attractor, that is in and of itself a benefit to the employee to be a part of that, that is a very powerful place for activation. What are the behaviors that should or could emerge from the work that we do in that area? And so those three areas, that kind of artist formerly known as internal comms, the digital transformation stuff, and culture as brand, those are the three areas that we really look at as the points of activation. And it can manifest in so many ways. And that's what's kind of, I think, very exciting about it.
Yeah, the whole thing about culture and purpose, I covered that back in episode 4. We had Dom Price on from Atlassian, and he spoke a lot about the future of work. And I think it's the three P's is, you know, people, place, and purpose. And we're told that millennials want a sense of purpose. So that's important. One thing that struck me, though, when I joined IBM way back in 2013, I was struck that there and then were what they called the social computing guidelines, essentially the social media policy. I understand you had a big hand in getting them developed and they were crowdsourced. But in the age of the employee advocate, where people like you and I have a very strong external presence, do these policies need to be updated or are they now obsolete because everyone's an advocate or an influencer?
I think it's a really great question. And what we're finding with our clients is it goes a little bit industry by industry. I mean, you know, the work that we did with IBM and establishing, you know, the kind of rules and norms for employee use of social media was very much informed by the business model of the company. And the business model of IBM is, you know, it's a knowledge company. It's a, you know, we are going to have all this expertise and we're going to be able to implement it and we're going to have the best practitioners. And, you know, and so it made a lot of sense. It was very aligned with the, you know, the business model to put up a blank wiki and invite a bunch of people to write the guidelines, you know, because we wanted to encourage those behaviors in a fairly free and open and exploratory way. Because there would be benefit in being able to advise our clients on that. And so you have, as a result, you know, even if you go look at those social computing guidelines today for IBM, they still, you know, are very, very, let's say, permissive or encouraging of authentic employee advocacy. And the kind of rhetorical move that we made, and I think is correct for a company that's in the services business like IBM, is to say your eminence in your field as a practitioner, if that's demonstrated, if we sort of highlight that, that accrues to the benefit of the IBM brand. And so it's very synergistic. However, you know, you have other organizations where that's just not the case. And in fact, you know, in other industries, let's say, organizations have to move with much greater care because of, well, not that we were careless at IBM, but like a different kind of care because they're operating.
Yeah.
They might be operating in a highly regulated environment like insurance or healthcare and so on. And we've worked with organizations in the insurance industry and in the healthcare industry where we've helped them to find their way for what's right to get their people talking about what makes it so great to work there. And then also set the rules of engagement for how we interact with customers in these spaces, given the regulatory requirements. So, you know, for example, an insurer in the United States, well, globally, but one operating in the United States has very specific record retention requirements, has very specific expectations set from a legal perspective on what they can and can't claim or offer. And so, you know, the behavior set has to be true to that. So we spend a lot of time kind of working with companies to do exactly what you said, revising their social guidelines or social media guidelines in order to have a more contemporary disposition. And I think, you know, there are many companies that they more or less came up with, you know, blogging guidelines or social computing guidelines in 2008. You know, they were kind of one word, don't, you know, just like, don't get us in trouble. And what's interesting now is that you have, you know, the leadership of those companies who are engaging on, you know, LinkedIn or, you know, or whatever, even a very prescribed way, who are, they're actually out of compliance with their own policies. And I think some of this advocacy at the leadership level is helpful now in driving a necessity to change it so that deeper into organizations, you can have authentic advocacy.
Brings me on to an interesting topic. You talk about eminence and the whole notion of advocacy at that leadership level. So where's the line between personal brand and company brand? I have a view on this and I've been in the middle of it a couple of times, but where do you sit there?
Well, for me personally, there is no line. Like as a founder and CEO, it's like the brand and me, like I'm like, we're very cozy. But I recognize that that's not the case for everybody. I think it ends up being a personal call. Though I think the higher you are in an organization's kind of leadership, in my estimation, it's incumbent on the leadership of organizations to sort of associate themselves very publicly. It's not just a marketing tactic, but it's a signal of leadership. You know, one of our clients is a company called PVH. They own well-known brands, Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein, Speedo, some heritage brands that are, I mean, they're really, really a great company. And they've done a lot of work, and we've had the privilege to help them with activating their employees around things that they know that their employees care about and truing up the company's policies and support so that, you know, in the moment of advocacy, you don't feel like a shill. So we help them with a program called the PVH Power Players, which is, you know, a social media ambassadorship program. But even before that, if you look at the hashtag WeArePVH, you will find an extraordinary amount of employee advocacy around environmental issues, LGBTQ rights and pride, and you know, career opportunities at the company and so on. I mean, I think it's really phenomenal that you, and many of the people who are contributing to that, they're hourly workers, they're in retail positions and so on. But they, you know, it isn't, I don't think, you know, a job description line item for them to advocate. And yet that company has made the policy decisions to be the kind of company where if you feel passionately about those issues, the company's platform becomes your platform. And so as an advocate of LGBTQ rights or of environmental protection, it's actually a benefit to me as an employee there to use the PVH platform to advocate for those issues. And I think that that's, to me, that's the kind of new value exchange that has emerged, where a organization, you know, a big brand, a, you know, multi-million or billion-dollar brand like PVH can confer this kind of authority, and the employees can in return confer authenticity. That's the kind of sweet spot, if you will.
Well, I think it's a value exchange. And I often talk about the fact that when you go to work now, you're kind of renting your brand to an organization. You asked me what my view was on personal versus company. I've got a little bit of a different attack because of my experience. So those listeners may know that back in Australia, I worked for a couple of large telcos. Then I spent 12 years running 6 startups, then IBM. And of the 6 startups, there were 2 where I had some very difficult conversations with the founders, because these were companies that were basically started from almost ground zero. They had no presence. And I had this existing social media presence. And like you, I was an early adopter of Twitter and LinkedIn. So at some stage, the founder would sit me down and say, Andrew, are you out there for your brand or our brand? And I said, I'm here for both. And the problem was that eventually the company brand would start to be as large as mine and they might compete. When I joined IBM, there was no chance that I could ever be as big as the IBM brand. So there wasn't any sort of differential. But I suppose when you have a board and people that are seeing what you're doing publicly, they want to know that, you know, if you're out there speaking an event or doing a blog post, it's not to promote Andrew Grill or Ethan, it's to promote the company. And I think there's a fine line there. And I don't think any guideline could say you can or can't do that. What I want to talk about, though, is eminence, because I think eminence is a little different from advocacy, and I want you to either correct or confirm my view. I think eminence is kind of the gold standard. You've probably got 1% of people in your organization that are already eminent. The example is, if you have a Nobel Peace Prize, your peers think you're eminent and you are recognized globally. And I had this discussion recently with a professional services firm that was scratching their head. They're a well-established consulting company. They've got people that are eminent, that have, they're on podcasts, they do public speaking, and the firm doesn't know what to do with them. And then even at IBM, we struggled. We had all these people. What do we do with them? The advocacy, I think, is probably broader. You want as many people as possible to advocate. But do you see also that eminence is that gold standard and you maybe only have a small percentage? And if you coach them, mentor them, put a bit of advertising money behind them, they may be even more successful in spreading the message than the broad base.
That's exactly right. And I think, just going back a little bit to your earlier point about, you know, showing up with your network and what that means, I mean, I think that's a factor of eminence. You know, you kind of can't be eminent, you know, without having networks that you work within and through and so on. And so there's definitely a tight correlation between those who are good at, you know, sort of fostering network effects around their work and those who gain eminence. You know, what we're seeing and what you are experiencing there, you know, particularly in the early days of it, was this emergent idea of network portability in relationship to work. I mean, this is one of the various dimensions of asymmetry of power that's breaking down in between particularly knowledge workers and their employers, where, you know, when I show up, I don't just show up, you know, with, you know, my skills and the hourly ability to, you know, to do those skills, or my expertise even, and, you know, sort of my ability to offer that understanding. But I show up with a network, and that network is available to me. And how much am I going to make it available to my employer is a question. And then when I leave, how much of that network growth, if it has grown, belongs to the organization, if you will, and what belongs to the person whose network it is. And I think, you know, to look at it through this kind of black or white lens of who owns what and who gets all the value is, I think, sort of misapprehends the opportunity.
Well, that's why I talk about renting, that basically while you're there for the 2, 5, 7 years you're working for it, there is a value exchange. I will do a great day's work. You will give me a great day's pay. I will loan you my network, but you're just renting it, because when I leave, I'm leaving with my brand intact and I move on to something else.
So this idea of network portability is so important because it's the opposite of the tactic that most organizations have employed historically, which is network lock-in. And, you know, historically, it's been, all right, come work for this company. We'll give you a set of sales leads. We'll give you a Rolodex. We'll give you access to the employee directory. And if you leave, we're going to take all those things away from you. And so that becomes an incentive to stay and a disincentive to leave. And this is, you know, anybody who's, you know, a Facebook user or a LinkedIn user or, you know, a Netflix watcher or whatever, you know, like, you get like what it means to have your network and your world of kind of all the things that you've tuned within it taken away from you. It's not a very attractive proposition. However, I think this is going to play out differently, or can potentially play out differently, for big companies, because no big company is big enough, not even, you know, Walmart with, you know, millions of employees, no company is big enough to say we're going to be the most valuable network of work. You know, if your professional life, we will be the most, like, you know, conclusively. I think the strategic approach vis-a-vis employee communications is to design your workplace and your value proposition of employment to be network permeable. You can bring your network and integrate your network with us. And then when you go, if it's grown or improved or whatever, that's good for you and that's good for us. So we're going to make it as easy to leave as it is to come. You know, whether you like it or not, that's happening, you know, within companies. I mean, just to look at one particular or two particular platforms, with LinkedIn and with Slack, you know, the global sort of opportunity for networking with other professionals is pretty much unlimited. And also you take it with you. So your ability to log into, you might get, you know, tossed out of a certain channel or something like that, but you know, within Slack, you also might have, 50 different organizations that you're affiliated with through Slack, and all of your connections, your professional connections and your ability to reach and reconnect with people might be reflected at this point in LinkedIn. And so there are these networks of professional life that are now so totally outside of the control of any one enterprise. You know, I think you kind of have to, as a employer designing a communication strategy, you know, to try to circle the wagons, that has a very limited future.
Final question before I ask you for your three top tips for next week. At Integral, you also look at digital transformation, which is one of my pet topics. What's the first step in getting your internally facing digital tools and platforms fit for purpose so employee voices can be heard?
Well, I always think we got to start with listening. And in this case, the listening is not just with your ears, but one of the things that we've done for a number of clients is an audit of the employee experience. And the employee experience, not just through like, oh, do they enjoy, you know, what's stocked in the pantry and that kind of thing, but like, what is the actual digital experience that people are having every day, you know, with communication systems, with systems of authentication and identity, you know, with their ability to collaborate with outside parties like clients or suppliers and so on. You know, like, let's take a look at that and see where people are today experiencing joy and where they're experiencing hardship. And one of the things that's kind of incredible, and this goes back to this idea of, you know, what the, you know, kind of digital workplace is, you know, when I started off in you know, doing employee communications, you know, years ago, it was not unusual for us to deploy some kind of enterprise software that required, you know, hours of training, you know, or a 20-minute video and, you know, step by step and all this kind of stuff. And that's still the case at a lot of organizations. And I think for very, very specific tasks, you know, like when there are tools that are very specific to a expert system, that makes a lot of sense.
As this is the Practical Futurist podcast, what three things can listeners do next week to start an employee engagement program?
Well, the very first thing is to, you know, start talking with employees. That might be all three, but I'll see if I can come up with another two. But the first one is, and it happens, you know, if you're off in headquarters and, you know, you're at a company that has a couple hundred, couple thousand, or a couple hundred thousand people, you can, you know, even in a very small organization, say nothing of those larger ones, start to have a rarefied experience of work that is very different from what most people are experiencing. The other thing I think we can do is we can really reinspect the kind of measures of our work. And, you know, very often folks who are in communications roles misapprehend the goal to be generate awareness. And awareness, as I have now learned again and again, is not a business outcome. It just isn't. And it is a necessary antecedent to generating business outcomes often, but what needle are we actually trying to move? And if you can, as a professional in your organization, identify what are some of the key pain points of the organization? Is it about security? You know, what can we do? What behaviors can we change that relate to some of these measures? So is it about security? Is it about, you know, volume of sales or customer churn? Is it about, you know, being an innovative place where people can take some risks and try some ideas? If you can reorient around some of those observable behaviors that are actual outcomes and work back from there, that'd be a great thing to do starting tomorrow for anybody. The third one that people can do immediately is inspect their own practice of iteration and of, sort of like planning and design time versus execution time and testing and learning time. And this was one of the things in my last role at IBM that I learned and came to deeply appreciate. I ended up, you know, becoming a certified Scrum product owner and, you know, sort of, you know, managing a lab of agile teams that were on very short cycles, you know, 2-week cycles of, you know, we would produce something, get it out the door and see how it performed. which was so different from how I'd spent most of the beginning, like more than half of my career, you know, coming up with these big plans and doing these big launches that might take, you know, months or even over a year to do. And they just never went right. The world of digital environments has enabled us to de-risk a lot of projects by getting smaller increments of value into the marketplace and seeing if they actually produce the value that we thought they would. That's something that we can all do tomorrow. And you could start by going, I mean, it's not a communications document, it's a software development document, but go to, you know, the Agile Manifesto. It's a one-page website. I think it's .com actually, agilemanifesto.com. And read that that foundational document. It'll take you 10 minutes, but it might change the next 10 years of your life.
So there's a great tip for comms professionals. Become a Scrum certified person and run things with Scrum. Look, great tips, great discussion. Ethan, where can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, I'd love to connect with your listeners and thank you for the invitation to do so. On Twitter, I'm EthanMCC. Happy to connect with you on LinkedIn. And my company's website is integralcomms.com.
Ethan, great chat. Thanks so much for your time today.
Andrew, thank you very much. This is such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Practical Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at futurist.london. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops at futurist.london. Until next time, this has been the Practical Futurist Podcast.